yeah, here's a stamp on a piece of paper that says like, yeah, you are now disabled, boom, off you go. And you're not given anything. And that's whether you have a limb difference, that's whether you have a spinal cord injury, that's whether you become like, you are suddenly diagnosed with neurodivergence. Like, it's all the same. You don't get this handbook that's like, okay, so here's a whole backlog of history that could help you. Here are some people that will be able to help you in the right direction. It does not exist.
Hello, and welcome to episode 102 of Disabled and Proud. This week's episode is a compilation of the best bits of Disabled and Proud from the past year. Because if you didn't know, this is the 2-year anniversary episode of this podcast. We have done some incredible things over the past 2 years. I have done over 100 episodes. I've done a live podcast at NADEX. I've got to chat with some of the most incredible disabled people there are in the UK and around the world. And I'm so excited to see where the next year goes. But for this week, please enjoy some of the best bits from the past year of Disabled and Proud.
Yeah, so I would refer to myself as an autistic ADHDer. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's kind of what I go with. I think there's quite a lot of debate with this one, especially within the autistic community, of like person first language or identity first language. And I think it's particularly hard to do with the combination of autism and ADHD, because it's like, yeah. I believe in like identity first language of like, I am autistic, it's a part of my being in the same way that being a woman is, but the language doesn't really allow us to do that with ADHD, because it's like, I am ADHD, it doesn't really work. So I kind of go with ADHD for now until we've got a better alternative.
Yeah,
I think ADHD especially is like, the name of it just doesn't even kind of, it's not even accurate really at all. Like, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, first of all, we don't really like disorder. Second of all, not everyone's got the hyperactivity side, you kind of just have an inattentive side, and it's not really attention deficit because sometimes I can focus too much rather than not enough. So I just feel like the whole name, we need a new one ASAP basically, but kind of working with it for now. So I think like the biggest thing that I grieved for, or the thing that I'd like held a lot of like bitterness for in the past, was dropping out of school, because I think it was, yeah, like if I'd have had the right support at that time, I would have been able to get my A-levels, I would have been able to go off to uni. I think that was the thing that I had a lot of like bitterness for at the time. So I think I've been really lucky that my career has kind of gone the way it's gone since I got diagnosed, because I've almost not had time to be sad about that, because it's like, it's kind of cheesy but true, like it's proof that everything happens for a reason, because now I'm doing things that I probably wouldn't have even had access to do had I have got those A-levels and degree.
What made you think, or like even pursue the idea of a diagnosis with autism and ADHD? What was the like catalyst for that as such?
Yeah, so I think, so I'd always been diagnosed in the past with kind of anxiety-related depression, agoraphobia, panic disorder. And I think the more that time went on, I just kind of realized that they just didn't really fit right. So yeah, the way that my kind of mental health like manifested, I guess, was that I would have like 6 months of being like fine, air quotes fine, of being like quite ambitious, quite bubbly, mm-hmm, quite energetic, wanting to do loads of things, like quite, I don't know how to word it, like just fine basically.
Yeah.
And then every 6 months or so I would just have a big crash and burn. So it would be like I'd become really overwhelmed, I'd become really tearful, I'd have these panic attacks, I wouldn't want to leave the house. That was kind of like a 6 month cycle, and it happened kind of like over and over again, of like, it happened the first time when I had to drop out of school, and then I kind of, mm-hmm, got myself better, and then I got a job, and then after 6 months I had to leave the job because I was too overwhelmed from the job, and then, yeah, it happened with another job, and then I'd been traveling and I had to come home from all of these things. It was just like whatever I did every 6 months or between 6 months and a year, I would have this big crash. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that I became really like just fed up with that basically, because it was just like, you know, I'm doing everything they've told me to do, I'm taking the antidepressants that they've told, yeah, me to take, I've done all of these therapies that they've asked me to do, I'm reading every single self-help book on the planet of to like how I can look after myself, and yeah, nothing is getting me to like where I want to be, it just catches up with me all the time. I think I was feeling really fed up with that, and I think like realizing that, yeah, it didn't, the labels that I'd been given just didn't really fit. Like, I wasn't an anxious person, I just became really overwhelmed when I had these like lower points. And I think it was like, you know, I'm not necessarily worrying. I just get to a point where everything is too much. So I think it was like just going around in my head of like, that there's something else going on here, but I just don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And then I went through a bit of a stage of being convinced that it was BPD, borderline personality disorder, because I think that was the only thing that I'd ever seen like as an explanation or represented on social media as a reason why a woman or person marginalized their gender might go from being very high to very low. It was kind of like the mental health side, the bipolar, the BPD. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's what I do. I go from having a really good phase to having a not so good phase. Like maybe that's what's going on for me. And originally started like trying to talk to the doctors about that. And they were just like, no, that's not you. That doesn't fit. Like, it's just anxiety. And I was like, it's not just anxiety. But they were kind of convinced that it wasn't that. And then it was just out of luck, really. So I was having counselling. I was kind of like getting to the point where I was coming back into one of the low phases. Mm-hmm. And I was going counselling through my job at the time. And I brought up a conversation that I'd been having with my partner at the time, like a little bicker we've had. And the counsellor just said to me, has it ever been looked into why you take things so literally? And my answer was like, no, it hasn't. But I think I know what you're hinting at here. And then kind of went away and did loads of Googling and searching on Instagram and TikTok and just whatever I could get my hands on, basically. Uh-huh. And I was just like, yeah, this is it. We found the answer here. So I think it was like a combination of the two of like, I was very much in that brain space of being like, something else is going on. I know that something else is going on. I need to find what it is, but I don't know what it is. And then just pure luck. Mm-hmm. Chance of having that comment. So it turned out afterwards that her son was autistic and ADHD, so I guess she'd maybe been able to pick up on things,
pick it up, yeah,
yeah, in the way that other people hadn't been able to notice it as much. So that was just, I guess, I think that's why I'm so grateful and why I feel such a need to like do this work to help other people get diagnosed. I think it's such like, especially like you say, there is kind of a wave of people, like the more that more people are talking about it, there is a wave of people having these discoveries, which is then really sadly met with just like grief from the media of like, oh, everyone's getting diagnosed now. There wasn't all this back in my day. Like, you know, it's a trend. Everyone's diagnosing themselves from TikTok. And it's like, no, that's not the case. These people are getting answers for things that they've struggled with their whole entire lives.
Yeah,
that should be a really joyous moment of like, oh, I finally understand who I am now. I can finally learn to work with myself. I can finally forgive myself. That should be a wonderful moment. Obviously it comes with the grief as well of like what could have been, but overall getting that answer should be a wonderful moment in someone's life, not something that's getting spoiled by grumpy man down the road going, oh, you're just jumping on the back of a bandwagon. I think it'll put people off going to speak to their GP or whatever, because they might think, oh, I don't want them to think that I'm just jumping on the bandwagon, or, you know, they might not take me seriously. And I think it's a really dangerous thing that's like kind of happening in the media at the moment. And I think, again, tying into that thing about the fact that it's women, I think if you were to it is a big generalization, but if you were to kind of reframe and it's like suddenly loads of men were getting diagnosed with this disability later on in life, I imagine it would be like, oh, you know, there's this wave, this is epidemic of people, we need to look into why this has happened. Yeah. We need to take this more seriously. But because it's mostly women and people marginalized for their gender, and people of color and trans people and all of these kind of marginalized groups of people that are the ones getting diagnosed, it's just like, oh, it's a bit of a bandwagon, everyone's jumping on it.
When people come into my room, there's an instant power dynamic, right? Somebody is coming to tell me potentially some of their innermost secrets that they've never told anyone. And they're walking into a room to tell a complete stranger who happens to have doctor in front of their name, whatever is going on with their lady bits or whatever it might be. There's a big power dynamic there. And they're asking me for help. They're asking me for something. And trying to kind of level that out can be really difficult, because I want them to have a say in, you know, that treatment's not going to work for me, or that's not something I want to try, or I've had bad experiences with that, whatever it might be. Those medical discussions should be a partnership, and so often they're not, but it's something we're constantly trying to do more and more of in medicine. And I think actually my visible disabilities, and particularly when I kind of talk about having ADHD, which I don't do often, but just occasionally I'll kind of go, no, my brain gets it. when I'm having those conversations, people see me and they go, right, she gets it. She must have seen a doctor before in her life. She knows what it's like to have a body that misbehaves. And having that very visible sign of, yeah, you're in pain a lot too, aren't you? Because you're sat in that thing and you're using that thing. And, you know, people do like almost immediately kind of come up to that level where we're having a conversation and we're not having a, please, sir, can I have some treatment type conversation.
Yeah. And I know for a fact that being diagnosed with EDS is not as simple as it seems, because it's incredibly, from my knowledge, is that it's incredibly underfunded. It's not as rare as we think.
Yeah.
But the symptoms that align with EDS are symptoms, well, I put symptoms in air quotes, as to what women would just be expected to just go through as women. So like sore joints, you're a woman, it's coming up to a period, sore joints, normal. Super bendy, you're a woman. Like there are so many symptoms of it that are just, that align so much with just like just having to get on with being a woman, which is problematic in and of itself. But how was your EDS journey? What was that like for you?
The EDS journey was it was a bit of a strange one. I mean, even by EDS standards, we all have weird journeys to diagnosis, and we're often diagnosed a lot later than we potentially should be. I was diagnosed when I was, I think I was about 26, 27, and I was already at medical school. So I'd been that person, shockingly, neurodivergent, who'd done 3 undergraduate degrees, and medicine was my 3rd. I had completed them, which for an ADHD I'm quite chuffed by. But yeah, medicine was my 3rd. And I'd decided to run a half marathon in memory of my brother who died while I was also at med school. And the way I was processing that grief was I was going to run this half marathon, raise lots of money, but box ticked, very medical, crack on with your life. Except my right kneecap started disappearing right round behind my knee, like would fully dislocate. While I was running, and other joints started like really not enjoying the running lark at all. And it got to the stage where I managed to complete the half marathon because I'm bloody stubborn and probably bloody stupid, if we're honest. Did it, but my joints were not recovering at all. And I was really lucky in that because I was at med school, I had a lecture, kind of teaching session one day with a rheumatologist who was teaching us how to do hand exams. And she was examining my hand as a demonstration and was just like, Hannah, you're really weirdly bendy. And I'm like, yeah, I know, always have been. I was that kid who did ballet for like 20 years or whatever. Like I've always been that bendy person. And she said, do you have any joint problems? I was like, yeah, actually, like my GP keeps giving me more and more like naproxen to try and help manage my pain. I've just bought my first walking stick. Nobody really seems to know what's going on. And she was kind of like, I think you need to go and see a colleague of mine. So got myself referred into rheumatology. And I did that medical student thing where like we diagnose ourselves with something new every week. We are all massive hypochondriacs because you can't learn about all these terrifying diseases and not sit there one night, like 2 in the library going, oh my God, do I have schistosomiasis? Yeah. Like
2 plus 2 is not making 4. Like what is wrong?
So I diagnosed myself and kind of turned up at this rheumatology appointment going, well, I think I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome type 3. And she's like, yeah, you definitely do. Crack on.
Your perspective on all of these topics is actually something that I'm really looking forward to talking about, because obviously you work within medicine and you're disabled and you're also neurodivergent. And particularly as like female presenting, you have ADHD, you have EDS, both the two things that women most often get called hypochondriacs for.
Oh yeah.
You have. And but to get to these diagnoses, it's not an easy path. Cause I know not so many people who have fought for their EDS diagnosis. I know so many people who are currently fighting for their ADHD diagnosis. And being in this system as well and actually having firsthand experience of how broken it is, because I'm not afraid to say that the NHS is broken.
It definitely is.
It's a commonly known fact. And you know, if you're sat there thinking that it's going to be saved and it's going to save itself, then I think you might need to have a bit of a reality check. And I'm really, really sorry if that's news to you, but like this is the situation that we're in.
Yeah.
But I wonder, with your EDS diagnosis, not like the most traditional route. You kind of diagnosed yourself and then just got like a thumbs up, which I kind of love.
Yeah.
But with your ADHD diagnosis, how was that, and how did that kind of present itself as something that you wanted to go down the route of?
So that was a bit more of a nightmare, to be honest. Looking back, I come from an incredibly neurodivergent family, and my brother's since been diagnosed. Like, mm-hmm. I speak to my parents and both of them are kind of like, oh, you clearly got this from your mum, or you clearly got this from your dad. And I'm just like, team.
Maybe it's both of you.
Really? Really? But I think because we were all like that, for us, it was the ways that we behaved were quite mm-hmm. normal, because yeah. that was all we really knew. And so through school, I was that kind of very intellectually achieving, comp educated. So it's kind of like, right, Hannah's fine. She's bright. She loves books. Yeah. She'll be okay. And so I was always, you know, well-behaved. I have hyperactive and inattentive type. So I was that kid who, yeah, I'd probably doze off in the back of the classroom or be completely off, you know, thinking yeah. of something else. But I was intellectually bright enough to keep up. Mm-hmm. So nobody yeah. ever really picked up on it. I mean, I look back now and I'm like, I did every club going, apart from sports, because I wasn't very sporty. I did do ballet, modern tap, jazz, like yeah. every orchestra, every choir. I was always in the music, like I was that drama geek. And so now I look back and I'm sort of like, my God, firstly, how did my parents get all of these children around to all of these activities every day? Like,
yeah, well done them.
Ludicrous. My mum's a wheelchair user. Like, I'm just like, absolute kudos. Yeah. And now I look back and it's like, of course I had ADHD, but I was only actually diagnosed when I was 34 and I'm 36 now. So it was wow. really recent. And I'd got through I did my first degree in English and theology with Arabic. I really struggled with Arabic, shockingly. Mm-hmm. It's quite a hard language.
I wonder why.
But the way I would just get completely overwhelmed whenever we had a test, mm-hmm. to the extent I'd have panic attacks and they had to put me in my own room for all my exams.
Yeah.
Because I would just completely freeze. My brain would just go, no, can't do this. Mm-hmm. And then I managed to get through that degree, then went and did pediatric nursing, which was okay because there weren't any exams. Well, there was one and you could tape like all of the notes in on a piece of paper. I was like, dream.
I love those exams where you had like, oh, you're allowed an A4 sheet of notes. My yes. writing would be like this big so I could fit everything that I needed to put on it.
So small.
Thought of that.
I mean, for my little wonky brain, it was the dream, I can tell you. And then I did med school where I struggled. Like, I found it really hard, but I always put it down to the fact that I hadn't got any science A-levels because I was coming mm-hmm. in as a postgrad who'd taken a different route. I had never studied science. So I felt like yeah. the reason I was studying was so hard and the reason I was struggling so much was because I was like just behind because I hadn't got the background yeah. everybody else had. But when I started my GP training, so I've been a doctor now for 7 years. I will hopefully mm-hmm. be a fully qualified GP in the next 6 months. But you have to do two big exams. One of them is a clinical one where you film yourself basically seeing patients and send them in and they go, yes, you're kosher, you're safe, well done, mm-hmm. tracking well, fabulous. Pass that one, flying colors, no bother, first time. But the written exam was horrific. I failed it the first time, and in fairness, I probably hadn't done enough work for that one. But failed it the first time, fine, like one in four of us do, not a problem. The second time I failed it by like one mark, but I put a lot more work in and I was devastated, like absolutely mm-hmm. broken, was sort of like, can I even be a doctor? What is this? Because I'd never really failed anything before. And I was yeah. like, what? Where did my brain go? And it was at that point, actually, that one of my supervisors who had a special interest in neurodivergency kind of contacted me and said, look, Hannah, 15% of people who fail this exam turn out, or more than that, turn out to be neurodivergent. And we think around 15% of GPs are neurodivergent.
Yeah.
Because actually, it's quite a neurodivergent friendly specialty. You get a new patient to play with every 10 minutes. My brain yeah. can't get bored in 10 minutes. I mean, it can, but it shouldn't. So actually, a lot of us tend to go into general practice because it's so good for a portfolio career. You get a lot of new patient turnover, all of this kind of stuff. And she's sort of like, I think you should get an assessment. And I was like, oh, fine, you know, let's see. I'd always kind of suspected I was, but I wasn't that bothered about getting the assessment. And then when I got it and they explained to me what it really meant and the impact it really had, it completely changed the way I viewed myself. Yeah. And I was so lucky because, again, so many people fight for a diagnosis. I was basically just sent to a service that the NHS paid for because they were sort of like, we need you to stay as a doctor. This is how we're going to get you to do it, is get you properly assessed and get you the support you need. And then most people don't get that either.
You have to live in my body to understand, I guess. So I currently, my current position is I work in operations for actually a prosthetic manufacturing company. Yes. So I, every single day, am thinking about, talking about, and serving the amputee community. It is my every day, right?
Yeah.
But that wasn't how it started for me at all. Yeah. Like if you would have told my college going 20-year-old self that this would be where I'm at 10 years later, like I wouldn't have believed that I'd be like working for a prosthetic company.
Yeah.
But kind of in a nutshell, what happened in my experience specifically is that I was always a theater kid growing up. I loved being on stage. I think a piece of that looking back is that it was a way for me and my different body to control the stares that I was inherently receiving anyway.
Which makes sense because it feels like you can direct where the staring is going.
That's right. And I can impress you with the performance that I'm giving you, right? So I have control over your thoughts around me in a positive way versus maybe a way that's pity or I feel sorry for you or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, completely.
Right. So, I mean, looking back, I think that's a big piece of the theater puzzle for me in particular.
Yeah.
But I went away to school and I actually got my degree in directing and theater management. Mm-hmm. So it was my dream to go live in New York and to work on Broadway shows. And so right out of college, I moved to New York City and I started working backstage a Broadway show and was on a career path to do like management work within that space, within the theater space. However, what became too hard for me to ignore was the fact that I wanted to be on stage, right? Like I still wanted to be in the middle of it, literally.
Yeah.
But I literally did not think that that was an option because I had never once seen a body like mine on a stage.
Right.
Literally, never once. So I ended up finding a loophole, and that loophole was pageantry. So in the pageant world, your literal job is to interview and try out being yourself. Like all you have to do is show up as yourself. And I was like, that's great. I can do that. And also you want me to sing a song even better. So I ended up going the pageantry route and ended up competing and winning the title of Miss Iowa, which is the state here and the states that I grew up in. And that's a year long job. So I went to compete at Miss America. And that journey was wild for me because what happened was when I won and actually went to Miss America, there was so much focus from the world on the fact that my different body was showing up in a space that's very much a box. Like when you think of these pageants, it's very much a box of a person that is going to those spaces. And it freaked me out. Nobody had taught me the history of disability. Nobody had taught me, you know, why it was a big deal that a body like mine was showing up on that stage. Like, no, I had not had any of the foundational education in my community. So instead, the experience for me was really, really traumatic. I just sank into myself and sank into anxiety and sank into depression and didn't understand what was happening.
Yeah.
So coming out of that, it was like, what I realized was cool. It's really cool to be a part of the disability community. Where are my mentors? Where are the books I can read? Where's the correct messaging on what my body is and how the world reacts to it? And really was able to feel empowered in that way. But at the same time, that literal experience of going on that journey and going to Miss America and experiencing that set my life on a completely different trajectory. So immediately afterwards, after that year of work, I continued on just speaking full-time. I spoke full-time for like 3 years. And then kind of continued on into different disability spaces and have landed here in a prosthetic world, which has been a really good fit for me. But it all was from that like trauma of trying to figure out what the hell the world was doing and talking about me and what is happening. Why didn't anybody teach me these things? I went from winning this title. And here's the thing is because I'd grown up in my body, I realized that there would be conversation around my body. I realized that it was going to be a piece of it because it's always going to be a piece of whatever I'm doing.
Yeah.
But the extent to what it became, I had no understanding of. So I went from winning one night to literally being like world news the next day. And that really freaked me out because first of all, I didn't understand the way that news outlets talked about us. So that was one layer. Like every single story that was printed all around the world was, how inspiring is it that this girl with a different body is going to Miss America, right? It's the us versus them messaging where, you know, it's that pity piece of it. I competed right alongside all of these other girls and feel like I won fair and square. You know, I'd like to believe that.
Yeah.
And yet the focus is how inspiring it is and how
for living your life.
Like, well done. Job. Good for exactly. And so that was very confusing to me. Like I've since come to learn that type of messaging within the news media is, you know, called inspiration porn. You know, where
it's a great and awful term all at once, isn't it? Like, because it does exactly what it says on the tin.
It synthesizes
it's so
harrowing. It is.
On the one hand, I have some sympathy for the differently abled and superpower brigade. I've got some sympathy in the sense that what they're trying to do is they're trying to take, as I perceive it, my weakness, my disability, my deficit, and they're trying to add to it. And you use the word elevate. Elevate is the best word, I think, for it. Trying to elevate what is. But what's actually happening, of course, with less able is that unquestionably you are taking away. And if you are taking away from an already marginalized community who does not, despite whatever the law may say, does not experience equality throughout society, where ableism and including our own internalized ableism is already rampant as it is, taking away and plunging us further down into the red is really quite dangerous and really quite toxic and harmful. An interesting one, isn't it? I mean, it's right up there in terms of diving straight in with the controversial subjects. I do like that. I will say straight off the bat, actually, that I've no problems with this particular D word. I've always considered myself to be disabled. It would be a struggle, especially given the severity of my hearing impairment. It would be a struggle to convince anybody, in fact, that I wasn't disabled relative to how dependent I am on these hearing aids. I know I do a very good impression of, and I do hate this phrase, but sort of normal, which I get told quite a lot. And, you know, and it's quite the backhanded compliment, but I'm not a fan of this sort of narrative around differently abled. And I'm not a fan of calling my disability a superpower. And one thing that I'll say at the outset is that if you are part of the disabled community, and you do identify using those terms, power to you. That's absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. But I just can't have that imposed upon me. I think that's something that for me, I've never, ever viewed my deafness as being a superpower in any way. The fact of the matter is that to me, it's a weakness. It's a deficit. It has certain advantages. It has certain positive traits that come out of that as a result. And indeed, sort of like one could even say, I'm proud of the person who I am as a result of what the disability has in a sense. But no, I do want the tag, the label, the wording itself of disabled normalized throughout society. And I don't feel that people should be forced into accepting the notion that we're either not disabled or we're just differently abled or it's a superpower. I mean, I could go on. There's a few other labels, but I think those three that I tend to see as most prevalent in society and tend to have the most debates around them. And of course, it's the famous, the infamous less abled, which I think that we, as with our, you know, we know disability is not a monolith, but one thing that we can all agree on, whether we consider ourselves superheroes or merely disabled, is that less abled absolutely will not do. So that, for starters, I just want to put out there, actually, sort of that I condemn in the strongest possible terms, whether I see it in a car park, whether I see it on a restaurant restroom door, when I see it on all of these different places in public, the message that is being sent out to members of the disabled community. And in fact, anybody who might just simply need to use that accessible space for what it is, accessible space, is actually having an even worse message put to them, which is that you're not disabled, you're simply less than. And that's quite the Pandora's box there, actually, that you have to wonder quite often sort of where the quality control is, where the marketing teams are. And as I say, nothing about us without us. And where are the disabled consultants? Where are the people who do have disabilities sort of being able to actually veto this stuff? And I suspect nowhere to be seen. I think for me, I mean, intersectionality is just absorbing that statement, really, because intersectionality is one of the most misused and widely abused concepts in all of DEI work. Mm-hmm. It's often co-opted these days to effectively just be synonymous with difference.
Yeah.
You talk about the oppressions of race and gender and how that actually affects a person's lived experience, how that affects how they experience our workplaces, how they experience society, what they might be subject to. As I said before, a Black woman, the things that she would be subject to that I would never be subject to. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that also, for me, comes across when it comes to disability. I talk a lot about how I experience my disability, however severe, in a rather privileged way because of my privileged attributes, my whiteness, the certain way that you're presenting, even the, I'll air quote it, but straight passing, that straight passing privilege that I have, I'm well aware of it. And that is something that I can't really co-opt, you know, sorry, I can't opt out of, rather. I have that privilege regardless. It follows me everywhere that I go. I'm even conscious of the way that I look and sound, you know, my physical presentation, this how I articulate myself. All of these things essentially sort of add up to a very privileged picture. So that disability is not the same impediment that it was to me as, you know, when I was a six-year-old and relatively defenseless without all of those power, without all of those attributes that have made me relatively powerful and safe in society. And it's not being talked about enough how a Black person or a member of the global majority, someone who is not white, experiences their neurodivergence and their disability perhaps in a completely different way, even if we're talking about exactly the same condition on paper.
Yeah.
So I like to talk about that a lot. I recognize that anti-racism, combating anti-Blackness is, and in fact, decolonization is the underpinning of DEI work. It's the reason DEI exists in the first place, and on account actually of the civil rights movement. It's not just difference for difference's own sake. There are actually layers to oppression. And if a person like me is in DEI, especially if I have a leading role in DEI, the first thing that I always want to ask someone who looks and sounds like me is, what's your take on anti-racism? And what are you doing around that? What do you understand around that? Are you deconstructing that racism in yourself? Are you really looking critically at yourself and your practice? Or are you simply just saying, well, I've got my, you know, single issue diversity? Are you simply just getting into the work to, you know, for your own self-serving reasons? So there's a lot to unpack that. And I sort of have a certain mistrust of, I will go so far as to say white people in leading roles of DEI, actually, if they're not very openly combating that anti-Blackness and dealing with anti-racism. I don't like that very much at all, seeing it when it's just DEI for the sake of, it's just LGBTQ+, or it's just disability, or it's just this, it's just that. It's all of those things, but it is absolutely underpinned by race and gender.
Yeah.
The funny thing is I think for the first time since becoming disabled, so I've been disabled pretty much since 14, and I feel like that definition has expanded as I've
struggled and wrestled with my own definition of it, but essentially I was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer at 14. Mm-hmm. And had my amputation at 17. So I've moved throughout multiple stages or types or forms of disability. Primarily I've dealt with chronic illness a large part of my teens, and then I am an amputee. It honestly got to a dark place where I just didn't feel like being here anymore. I really could not imagine a good life for myself in this body. I was so wrapped up in grief and sadness and just devastated about what I thought I lost. And I thought that all the hopes of me having a good life, or a quote unquote normal, which what is normal life, were gone the moment I had that surgery. So I literally like drug my feet, like ran, did anything I could to not accept that. And I was in terrible denial before my surgery, to the point where if I hadn't been a minor at the time, I think I would have just continued to run from it, because my parents were like, no, we have to do this. This is the only way to save your life. So I would say 2020, I really had to sit with a lot of those feelings. Like there was nowhere to go. There was nowhere to run. Like,
what a great time.
Yeah. What a great time to be alive. So I had to sit and confront a lot of those things that I had continued to try to run from. And it got, you know, to a dark place. I'm like, okay, what do I want to, you know, at least give myself a shot or a chance? Like, what if I just, you know, fake it till I make it type of thing? What if I pretend that I can have a good life in this body? And I think over time, like I started to see just how I started to adapt physically. And I think mentally to that question or that notion, like, oh, okay, like all of these things that I thought were terrible are ableism. They're not actual real things like that in my life. Like I was like, I still have friends. I still have family. I still like have found new ways to enjoy the things that I like doing even without an arm. So I was like, okay, let me just continue to fake it until I make it. And I started to realize, okay, like different does not inherently mean bad. And I think for a long time, I thought that, okay, different is bad. Nobody wants to be different. Everybody wants to be, you know, be this one cookie cutter idea of perfect. And I was like, if I start to challenge that and chip away at it, like bit by bit, like the smallest pieces, like maybe it's something that I can eventually digest.
I love the fact that actually for you, coming to terms with disability meant that you realized ableism was so embedded in society, because I think a lot of people don't seem to realize that the vast majority of our views or our notions surrounding disability all actually boil down to ableism.
Yeah.
And like it can be such a difficult one to confront when you're like, oh, like actually, I don't really feel this way. This is society. And that is like a crazy, it's like a little melting pot, isn't it? Where you're like, oh my goodness, like my world is blown apart and I can see where all the flaws in society are. Like, yes, give me the key.
Yes. And I think that for me, and especially like in the last couple of years, just like reaching out to more people in the community and like finding literature and like books written by like us, like this community, like I started to realize, okay, a lot of the language that I had that was like so like negative, such negative self-talk, such like so bad and down on like myself, is not something that like exists like just naturally. This is something that was created. And I think that in realizing that, it felt like a liberation, but it also, like you said, feels sad because you realize just how entrenched it is and how much you have to almost every single day, if not every day, confront some part of it within either in yourself or like outside of yourself. So it's like just a constant like evolution. Like, how do I continue to like pull these terrible things away and then sort of deal with what I'm left with?
Yeah, almost like rebuilding the whole thing, especially for yourself, because you've gone from, you know, pre-disabled ableism is probably not necessarily in your scope, to then suddenly like it all smacking you in the face and you're like, oh my god.
Yeah, it was a pretty fast education. You almost have to, just to I think be able to be mentally okay. Like you have to, whether it's tools from like a support group or like just resources or a therapist, like you have to have something that's actively like helping you, because otherwise it can be completely overwhelming. And there were a lot of times I just felt like shutting down because I was like, okay, even as I'm understanding that the problem is not me, I was like, there's still so much to confront, just so massive and so institutionalized and so a part of our culture. I felt this enormous pressure and survivor's guilt to feel the need to do something extraordinary, because I feel like those are the people in the community that, as I started to see more representation, I was like, this is amazing. I was like, but I'm also not a Paralympian. So what am I supposed to do? And I was like, I don't know. So I really, really, really struggled with that. And there's still days where I still do, because you do feel this pressure to be like, okay, if I'm not extraordinary, am I a good disabled person? If I'm not an advocate, am I a good disabled person? All of those things that, you know, put that pressure on you and do kind of, you know, in hindsight, definitely funneled me into more of a box versus now I'm trying to broaden and do all the things that I wanted to do that I thought couldn't.
I honestly think that that is such like a nugget of gold for disabled people, is that you don't have to be a Paralympian. You don't have to be inspirational. Like, you do not have to be like this crazy, inspirational, successful individual. Like, you can just exist. And like, that is absolutely okay. Like, you do not need to do anything to prove, almost like, prove your disability is worth something. That's not what this is about.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, especially as, again, like, I started to see that representation, like, I'd see people on the Ellen show and like on, you know, all these like talk shows, and I'm like, okay, this is amazing. Like, I would have never otherwise have seen their story, but I was like, it does, like you said, send that message. Like, if I don't become inspiration porn, is my story valuable, and does it have, you know, is there room for it in the, you know, big collection of multiple beautiful disabled stories that there are.
Yeah. And that's like so key, is that, and I talk about it quite a lot, is that it, generally with disabled people, it can tend to be like Paralympics or pity, and there's not really like an in-between. It's either you're an incredible success, or it's you are down and out and it's an absolutely horrendous life, and there's not really an in-between.